Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker is Dr. Leighton Talbert of the BJU Seminary faculty.
All right, we're going to be in Ezra and Nehemiah this morning as we look at opposition in the work of God from both a human and a divine perspective. Paul reminds us that we don't wrestle with flesh and blood, but with a spiritual adversary. And we are to equip ourselves so that we'll be able to stand against what he calls his wiles, his methods, his strategies. And those are the strategies of the devil, who is the slanderer. We're going to see some of that. The strategies of Satan, the adversary. We're going to see that. But Ezra Nehemiah furnishes, I think, a fascinating study in the methods of opposition. And many of you, I think, will recognize some of these from your own personal experience. Some of you will probably recognize many of these from your own personal experience. I'm not going to tell you how many opposition strategies there are because you might get nervous that we won't get done. We will get done. But the first of these surfaces in Ezra chapter 4. If you go ahead and turn to Ezra 4. But the first one doesn't sound like opposition at all. Ezra 4, beginning in verse 1, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as ye do, and we sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, which brought us up hither." Of course, Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the leaders say, "No way." But this sounds so sincere. It sounds so neighborly. It sounds so ecumenical. I am pretty certain that a number of modern religious leaders would not have been nearly so antagonistic in their response, much more open-minded in their response to such a kind-spirited gesture than these ungracious, narrow-minded, suspicious separatists. How do we know they posed a threat? Well, because of their divine identity in verse 1, they are adversaries. Unfortunately, adversaries don't come to us with a big placard on their chest. But we also know that they posed a threat because of their self-identity in verse 2. Their doctrines, their affiliations, their associations speak louder than their words. And their syncretistic beliefs and worship, which are implied in verse 2, we know who they are, we know where they came from. You can read 2 Kings 17 to get a detailed account of their doctrines and their affiliations and their associations. Their syncretistic beliefs and worship posed a serious threat to the purity of God's people, their doctrinal purity as well as their lifestyle purity. And this transitions in the next two verses, in verses 4 and 5, into a second opposition strategy. The first one, by the way, is participation, which doesn't sound like an opposition strategy at all. But the second opposition strategy in verses 4 and 5 is harassment, both verbal and otherwise. The people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah, troubled them in building, hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. And then what you have in verses 6 through 23 is a third opposition strategy. But what Ezra does here is telescope forward in time to opposition strategy that they faced in connection with the rebuilding of the city and the walls, not the temple. We know that for a number of reasons. For one, the first letter that is mentioned here in verse 6 is a letter to Xerxes or Ahasuerus. That's in the 480s, about 485. The temple's long been built. Verse 7 mentions a letter to Artaxerxes. That would be in the 460s B.C. And verses 8 to 16 mention probably a second letter to Artaxerxes in the late 450s. And verses 17 to 22 record Artaxerxes' reply to this. Now, what I find interesting about this particularly is I recently received a newsletter from a missionary friend of mine in New Zealand. I got this within about 24 hours of teaching through this material on Ezra and Nehemiah and these opposition strategies and in exposition of historical books about 3 weeks ago. And their church purchased land and licenses to build a new church in a very nice new neighborhood. The pastor, he has already moved his family into that neighborhood. Plans have been drawn up. Site work has been done. And all of a sudden, the people in this neighborhood have rallied to stop this church building. They're holding neighborhood meetings to rally against this. They're utilizing this opposition strategy, which I would call legislative intervention. They're utilizing this, writing letters and making the process as slow and expensive as possible for this church, trying to kill the building project. And his letter recounts some of these activities. And if you read the letter to Artaxerxes that is recorded in this chapter, you also find some additional dimensions, some additional angles to this particular opposition strategy of legislative intervention. For example, if you look at verse 12, you find misrepresentation. Be it known unto the king that the Jews are building the rebellious and the bad city, the evil city. Disinformation in verse 13. Be it known unto the king that if this city is built and the wall set up again, they will not pay toll, tribute, or custom. They're not going to pay any taxes. Says who? Where is this coming from? Disingenuousness in verse 14. Our only concern, we don't want to see the king's dishonor. We're concerned for you, O king. And then finally, in verse 16, another dimension of this legislative intervention strategy is hysterical alarmism. We certify the king that if this city is built and the walls thereof set up, by this means you shall have no portion on this side. You're going to lose your whole dominion over here if you let this city be built. Hysterical alarmism. And verse 24, the last verse of this chapter, indicates that the opposition to rebuilding the temple by way of harassment that goes back to verses 4 and 5 was successful. They stopped the building of the temple for about 15 years. Verse 23 indicates that's the reply, the response to Artaxerxes' reply to their letter when he replies and says, all right, tell them, stop building that city until I say otherwise. And so they go up in verse 23 and by force make them stop. So the opposition to rebuilding the walls in the city by way of legislative intervention was even more successful. For nearly a century, Judah was prevented by local opposition and now by royal decree from rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. And that's where Nehemiah enters the picture. If you want to go ahead and turn to Nehemiah chapter 2, he's going to detail even more opposition strategies. Now, in connection with the rebuilding of the city itself, Ezra 4, you remember, records the letter to Artaxerxes and his reply that the building of the city and the walls be stopped until he says otherwise. Well, in Nehemiah 1, he says otherwise. And he commissions Nehemiah to go back specifically to build the city and the walls. And Nehemiah lays plans for this in chapter 2, and predictably, antagonists soon surface. You've got Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, who carry on the tradition of opposition started by their forefathers that's described for us back in Ezra. And the first opposition strategy that surfaces here, this is actually the fourth altogether, is open disdain. Look at chapter 2, verse 19. When Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? Here they're mocking them at the absurdity of this, but they're writing letters to Artaxerxes trying to make this into a real serious threat. They know there's no threat here. Now, these men certainly had political and probably other reasons for their opposition to the rebuilding of Jerusalem. But anybody that reads their Bible believingly understands that that human opposition is spurred by a much more far-sighted adversary who sees serious messianic significance to the rebuilding of this city. And we should not be ignorant, as Paul says, of his devices. In other words, whether the Jews' human enemies understood this or not, whether the Jews themselves understood this or not, the human opposition that they were experiencing was not political, it was not commercial, it was not social, it was theological. That's not always apparent to your human opponents. It's not always apparent to us. But it's the case. Opposition has a larger dimension that we have to be aware of. That's Paul's whole point in Ephesians chapter 6. But the other side of that coin is that God's work has a larger dimension as well. And I think we need to keep this in mind also. Because God is restoring Jerusalem not just for the sake of that remnant. He is actually providentially orchestrating the circumstances for the sending of His Son, their Messiah, into the world in the fullness of time. This is part of constructing that fullness of time. In other words, God's purposes regarding Israel are bigger than this remnant. And God's purposes for the church are bigger than me and my congregation. Chapter 4 moves us into a fifth opposition strategy, verses 1 through 3 of Nehemiah 4. And I would define this as demoralizing mockery. Verse 1, when Sanballat heard that we built the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, "What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make it in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish that are burned?" And Tobiah the Ammonite tries a little stand-up comedy. Well, even what they build, if a little fox runs up on it, it's going to fall over. To come back to my friend's newsletter, this was interesting as well. When I got his newsletter, I emailed him just to encourage him. I mentioned these opposition strategies and these passages that we're looking at this morning. And I believe it was a Wednesday. He read these passages to his church that night. They were very encouraging to them, he said. And he said some of the parallels to their experiences were uncanny. In fact, he mentioned that when they read this passage, there was one neighbor who had literally complained about the safety and the integrity of their retaining wall. And he contacted the local council and got engineers out there to look at it to be sure it was safe and wouldn't fall over. And this is not just ancient history. This is changeless human nature and the timeless tactics of an adversary. And again, some of you know that on a very personal basis. Chapter 4, verses 7 to 23. Give another opposition strategy. And that is violent conspiracies, plans for violence. It's a lengthy section. I'm just going to call your attention to a couple of verses here. Look at verse 7. It came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, they got a lot of enemies, heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped. They were very wroth and they conspired, all of them together, to come and fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. And our adversary said, verse 11, "They shall not know, neither see, till we come in the midst of them and slay them and cause the work to cease." But, verse 15, our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their counsel to naught. One more thing my friend mentioned in his missionary letter is that a number of people have phoned them and come to their door and knocked on their door and complained in a very unfriendly manner about what's going on. Made their hostility very apparent. Don't know that there have been any threats of violence, but I know of other situations where ministers have experienced that. You do too. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, gives its seventh opposition strategy. Chapter 6, verse 1, "It came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that no breach was left in it, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates," so the city is still vulnerable, there's no gates there, but the walls are finished, "that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me," verse 2, "saying, 'Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono.'" This strategy, invitation to dialogue, is a very subtle one and potentially a dangerous one, because it seems on first blush to signal maybe a breakthrough in the relationship. After all, they just want to talk. And you don't want to be intractable. You don't want to seem unreasonable. You can talk, can't you? Nehemiah smells an ulterior motive in verse 2. Probably they meant to assassinate him. And their appeals were suspiciously persistent. Verse 4, he says, "They sent four times to get me down from the work and to come talk to them." And he refuses. He calls their bluff. The fifth time, in fact, verse 5, the strategy takes on a new twist. 6, 5 through 9 recounts opposition strategy 8, and that's threats of slander. They play the libel card. The fifth time the guy shows up to call him to meet, and he's got an open letter to the king, Artaxerxes, which they're threatening to send, accusing Nehemiah of monarchical ambitions and rumors of rebellion. That the charges are false and groundless makes no difference to them. The whole point of this is to force Nehemiah to the table or create suspicion. And again, Nehemiah calls their bluff, send it. It's fine with me. But they are not out of tricks yet. Because 6:10 through 14 gives a ninth opposition strategy, and I would call this infiltration. Judah's enemies employ an insider, a Jew named Shemaiah, as a fifth columnist in hopes of undermining Nehemiah's leadership credibility. The intrigue of this little story is really fascinating. He agrees to be a double agent, as Shemaiah does, and he pretends to prophesy a warning that this gang of thugs is coming to get Nehemiah, a warning from the Lord. This gang of thugs is coming to get Nehemiah, and he needs to flee into the temple and take sanctuary. And Nehemiah spurns the idea, then discovers that it was a plot to create panic, to undermine his authority, to destroy his credibility, to demoralize the people. So, we come to chapter 6 and verse 15. And despite all this external opposition and even internal treachery, the wall is constructed, by the way, during the months of July and August. I thought that was kind of neat. We know when they constructed these walls, during these months, July and August. And they completed them in 52 days, much to the chagrin of their enemies. Verse 16 mentions that, when our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. That's what you want people to see. That's what you want your people to see. But there's one more opposition strategy that surfaces here that's going to haunt the remnant of God's people for years to come. And that's in verses 17 through 19, opposition strategy 10 is the last one. And that's individual accommodation and compromise. Look at verse 17. Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah, the leadership of God's people, let that sink in for a moment, sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them. For there were many in Judah sworn to him because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah. And his son Jehanan had taken the daughter of Meshulam. So there's this intermarriage. He's woven into the fabric of this community now. Also, they reported his good deeds before me. Hey, Nehemiah, come on, lighten up. Tobiah's a good guy. Look at what he did here. Listen to what he did there. Here. They're reporting his good deeds to him. And they report back to Tobiah everything that Nehemiah says. And Tobiah sends a letter to put him in fear, he says. And all of this comes to a head in Nehemiah 13 when, after an absence, Nehemiah comes back to Jerusalem and discovers that Sanballat, remember him, is intermarried into the high priest's family. And Tobiah, also related by marriage to some of Judah's leading citizens, is living within the very temple precincts at the invitation of the priest. And Nehemiah pulls his hair out. In fact, he goes one better. He pulls their hair out. Literally. Because he understands what is at risk in this kind of compromise and accommodation. 10 opposition strategies. They don't always come in that order. They don't always all come. But there's a variety of opposition strategies. There's one more consideration I want to call to your attention, though. And that is God's perspective on delay. No opposition or delay is outside the providence of God. I think we all understand that. In some cases, the delay itself may be the will of God. We get very frustrated and impatient with delays because our time is limited, we think. God's is not. And we're frustrated by opposition. God is not. And the fact is that the opposition and the delays in rebuilding Jerusalem were essential for accomplishing God's will. In fact, I'll take that up a notch. The opposition and delays in rebuilding Jerusalem were God's will. How do I know that? Because before God's people ever set foot back in that land to face the exasperating antagonism of their enemies and all the plots and the ploys designed to hamper their efforts to do what they knew was God's work and God's will for them, the Lord had already issued a prophecy that took all of those impediments and interruptions into account. It is a messianic prophecy of mammoth proportions and yet very intimate implications that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, Daniel 9:25. This prophecy designates with astonishing precision the timing of the coming of Messiah. And it ties that timing to a specific historical event, the command to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. That command came in 445, when Artaxerxes reverses his previous decision to stop the rebuilding, sends Nehemiah back specifically to rebuild that city, gives that command in 445. And when you work through the details of that prophecy, you discover that the time prophesied to elapse from the going forth of the commandment, from 445, takes you to AD 30. After which, the prophecy continues, Messiah would be cut off. So you've got this basic time structure here. 539, Daniel receives this prophecy that I just mentioned. 536, 3 years later, God's people are back in the land, rebuilding the temple, facing opposition. 20 years after that, they finally finish the temple in 516, but they're still facing ongoing opposition to the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem, decade after decade after decade after decade, until 445, the command to rebuild that city is given, setting the prophecy of Daniel in motion, given almost a century earlier. So in retrospect, that command can't come until 445. That means that all those decades of delay were not only foreknown by God, all that delay was foreordained by God. God already had determined a timetable that factored in those delays. You say, maybe, but we don't have any more prophecies like that that would explain our delays. No, that's true. Maybe God doesn't have more prophecies like that, but He still has purposes. And remember, His purposes for His church are always bigger than you and your ministry. So regardless of what it looked like from human perspective, down here at ground level, through all those years and years of delay, God kept everything on His timetable. He always does. He always will. And in the midst of relentless and sometimes devious and hostile opposition, that should be a really stabilizing encouragement for us.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Leighton Talbert of the BJU Seminary faculty. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.